Good morning, everybody. Golly, this is a good-looking group of diseased people, I'll tell you. before I begin and even introduce myself, I'd like to share something. AA was gracious enough and kind enough and loving enough to give us the 12 steps, the traditions, and actually the concepts, a little wording it differently. And so I had to steal something from one of my favorite AAs. And this seemed to work for him, and it has worked for me the few times that I've spoken. And so I'll ask your indulgence. I know we had a moment of silence. And what I'd like to do is have another moment, and I'll ask my higher power, who I choose to call God, to enter my mind and my heart and for me to say what he wants me to say. And in the same token, I ask you to ask God to enter your mind, your heart, and your ears to hear what he wants you to hear. So we'll just take a moment, please. Amen. Thank you. I am Joan Haslett, and I'm a very grateful member of the Worldwide Fellowship of Al-Anon. Hi, everybody. Now, because I was the wife of an alcoholic, and I'm the mother of an alcoholic, that does not make me an Al-Anon. That's like an alcoholic in Memphis going down on Beale and 4th and grabbing the closest drunk and say, here's my AA buddy. So in Al-Anon, we say that it's someone who goes to meetings regularly, works the 12 steps, has a sponsor, and gets involved in the fellowship, in the program. So I'd like to give you just a little background. I was born in Memphis. And I'm not ashamed to tell my age. I'm just thankful to Almighty God I've made it. I was born in 1930, and for you that are a little slow, that makes me 73. and so if you've lived with alcoholism, I mean, you know, you could almost wear a badge for that. I'm just very pleased. I was the baby, the only girl. I have two brothers. My mother and father were middle-class people. My father worked for the railroad until I was born, and he joined the Memphis Police Department. Well, my mother was 17 when she married my father, and he was 18, and she became pregnant after just probably about 8 or 9 months, and she had a little girl, and she died. And after that period of time, I had an older brother who's 5 years older, and he was tall, dark, handsome, and extremely smart. A lot of fun. And his nickname was Sugar. I still call him Sugar. And then I had this other brother, and he was born premature. And oh my God, I heard how we lost Frank. And in those days, they didn't have incubators, so they would rub him down with olive oil or baby oil, wrap him in cotton and towels, and they'd turn the oven on for the heat and put the door down, and they'd put Frank in the oven. Well, through the years, this is the little boy who could do no wrong, and he'd do things, and he'd say that I did it. He blamed it. He was torment me all the time. And so there are many times I thought, I wish they had just shoved that hug in there, closed that door, and jacked up that heat, you know. As I heard this, you know, at least three times a week, and every time mother would talk to a relative, oh, Frank is just doing fine. And then there was Joan. I was skinny. When I was a year and a half old, they didn't know what happened. They think I fell out of the swing and my eyes were crossed. It affected the nerves, but I think it affected more than the nerves in my eyes, to tell you the truth. So, and I do have this disease of perception, I guarantee you. I don't see things a lot of times like in other people, and it's not through eyesight, believe me. It comes from here down. And so I learned early on that my picker was really broken because I saw double till I was almost 8 years old. And we used to have those concrete posts, you know, and I'd walk down the street and I always saw two of them. And decision, decision, decision. I had to make up my mind. My picker was broken, so you know what I did. Every afternoon I'd run into at least one pole because I lived on a horseshoe circle and there were about 8 of those. So it was treacherous for me to walk around the block, I guarantee you. Well, I failed the first grade. I used to hide that fact, but I don't anymore. I couldn't see. But, you know, I used that. I've heard the alcoholics talk about the things that happen in their lives and how they use that as an excuse. Well, I used that as an excuse, too. If I didn't want to do something, I couldn't see to do it. But I guarantee you one thing. I didn't join into anything unless I thought I could win. So I was very competitive as a child. I was very fortunate in those days. I had an ophthalmologist that gave me exercises in my eyes with glasses straightened out. Well, I went through public school, and then in the 10th grade, I went to an all-girls school. And that wasn't as bad as you'd think, because when the doors were open, when it was 3 o'clock, all the boys from CBC, which was an all-boys school, would be there. So we had a lot of fun together. We did plays and operettas and all. So at any rate, in high school, I loved to dance. Oh, and I am one of these romantics. Oh, you can just woo me. You know, it's the right music and the swaying. And I wondered why I was so popular, because I always went out with these good-looking boys. And then it wasn't until this program, I remember, I had an uncle who was the manager of the Peabody Skyway and Roof, which is the place in Memphis to go. And so we always went free. And I thought, well, you know, boys are always asking me to go dancing, you know. Duh. So, you know, I always walk to a little different beat anyway. Well, I was engaged to this young man, and he was very nice looking, athletic, and I have a real aversion to Italians. If you're Italian, please keep it a secret from me, because I don't attack, but I might move in a little closer, you know. So this guy was Italian, good-looking and all, and he had a brother. His mother and father were divorced, and we were over at his house one night. The reason I'm telling you this, I firmly believe even a broken clock is right, at least twice a day. You know, if it's broken, it's going to be right. So even before I came into this program, God gave me these little inklings, you know. So we were over at his house, his mother's house for dinner, and he asked his brother, whom he swore, oh, he loved him, you know, real close brothers, for the salt and pepper. And they start kibitzing back and forth. The next thing I knew, man, they were going pushing and shoving, and they were out in the backyard. And next thing I know, they're beating each other's brains out. And I walked out there to the screen door at the porch, and I looked at that, and I thought, hey, he says he loves his brother. And there he is beating the stuffings out of him. I wonder what he's got in mind for me. Yeah. Well, we were engaged, and so I took his car key, and I told his mother, I said, when they quit fighting, you can tell him, I've gone home. I have his car. He can come get the keys, but I never want to see him again. And that's exactly what happened. I was so fearful of violence because, you see, as a child, I can remember looking over the benches in a courtroom. I'd go to the court with my father. He was his police officer. And I can remember looking over those before I did a church even. And I'd see these people come in with their heads bandages and cuts and bruises, and it would be, you know, what do they call it, family disturbances now? Well, they call it assault and battery then, you know. And so I was always real leery of violence, and so that just turned me off. Well, I became engaged again, another Italian. And he was tall, dark, and handsome, and he had come home from World War II, and he had been a bombardier, and then he later on was a co-pilot, and, you know, Snoopy with his little helmet and his scarf, you know, and I had all those romantic ideas, you know, and oh, he was something else. So we became engaged, and he went through this particular school for wood grading, and he was looking for a job, and he was going to find us a house. He had heard about this job in Kansas City. Make a long story short, he was coming back every week, then every 2 weeks, every month, and then maybe about every 8 weeks. But one day, I go to the mailbox, and there's this large white envelope, and I open it, addressed to me, and I opened it up. Would you believe it was a wedding invitation of his to the boss's daughter? Well, I cried myself sick, you know. And at these particular times, God was taking care of me, and I never really knew it. But you talk about rejection. You know, when you're 19 and 20 years old and those things happen, you feel a lot less than. Well, at that particular time, I didn't want to have anything to do with men. That was it. You know, they weren't to be trusted. You know, you're all liars, or, you know, you can't be trusted. So this friend of mine who I had triple dated with in high school kept telling me about this brother of hers. Oh, he is so sweet. He is so handsome. He is just wonderful, 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 you know. Well, at that time, her mother had had cancer surgery and had come home from the hospital. And so Jackie, this friend of mine, and I talked about taking her mother to a movie. So I went by to pick her up, and she had been on me. I'm like, oh, you've got to meet this brother of mine. He is so nice. Tom, I said, I don't want anything to do with men. That was it. And I said, I'm going to tell you something. And I was not a Catholic at this time, but I was working downtown, and I would go to this church in the downtown area, and I would pray to God to soften my heart that I didn't trust men, I didn't like men, and yet I felt like someday I'd like to be married and have a family. But if there is anybody, God, you have in mind, you're going to have to put him there, and you're going to have to make it unavoidable, because I am not looking, and I don't really want anything. So anyway, she kept telling me about this brother, and I said, no, you don't understand. I don't want any kind of a relationship. Well, this one night, they went over there to get her mother, and she did not feel well. So she said, well, Tommy wants to come. That was her brother. And I said, I told you, I don't want to meet him. I don't want anything to do with this. Let's just go to the movie. No, I've already told him. He's in there. He's taking a bath. He's getting ready to go. And I told him we could go, he could go. And I said, well, that's not your place. I was driving. My mother and father were in Denver. And at that time, my father had left the police department, and he had an automobile lot. Excuse me, my manners. I never did thank Milton and the committee for asking me. I was vaccinated with a phonograph needle, I believe. And Milton, I apologize, and I want to tell everybody what a wonderful week this weekend this has been. But we go back, and she said, come on in, he'll be ready in just a minute. Well, I went in, and I sat on the arm of this couch because I was going to make a quick getaway. You know, I didn't want anything to do with that. Well, I was sitting there on the arm of the couch, and in walks Tommy. And I took one look at him, and I don't know to this day what happened, but I mean, I became a babbling fool. I was she introduced me, I couldn't talk, and all I could do was get up. And my knees were even weak. I couldn't hardly walk. And I got to the door, and I started to the car, and oh, he opened the car door. He was such a gentleman. And there's a few people here that knew my husband, Tommy. And when you could have seen him when he was 28, and this is something else. She kept saying, he's 28. I said, well, if he's all that good, some woman would have snatched him by now. I thought he was a retread somewhere, you know. Well, we went to the movie, and he grabs me by the arm, and he says, oh, there's two seats over there. And I know I was shaking like a leaf. This is nothing today. You young people think, what is she talking about? But when he reached over and grabbed took my hand and held my hand, man, it was like a shock of electricity went through me. It was chemistry from the very start. Well, needless to say, I didn't date anybody else. We dated for a whole year. We got married, and we had a beautiful wedding. It was wonderful. And we had a good life. We bought our first house. We had a lot of fun. By that time, I didn't mention this too, I had been taking instructions to become a Catholic. I'd had a disagreement with the church that I was going to, and I started in this search, and I was always been a seeker. And I went to, you just name it, whatever church you're in, you say to yourself, she's been there. And I had been. And I had a Jewish grandmother, which I didn't, you know, mention. And I didn't know my grandmother. She died before I was born, but I knew all of her brothers and sisters. And I used to take my great aunt to the synagogue on Saturday and then go to the Peabody for lunch. I went to all of these churches, and I had started taking instructions to become a Catholic when I met Tommy. And he came to my baptism in the church. And so, you see, when we got married, there was something that was very, very deep in my mind and in my heart, is that we exchanged vows, but to me, I had made that commitment to God about Tommy. And so my marriage vows were very sacred and very holy and very meaningful to me. Well, we started going up to the Catholic Club and partying, and, you know, Tommy would sometimes say, I don't want to drink. If I have a drink, he says, I'll drink more. And I'd say, well, one's not going to hurt you. He said, well, I know that if I take that drink, I'll drink more and more, and I just don't want to do that. And so he would go times without taking a drink. Well, when we started going up to the Catholic Club, and they had wine tasting parties, you know, and he was always of service, I can guarantee you that. Well, when it came to wine tasting party, he was going to help them set them up, and it was like, one, two for them, and three, four for me, you know, and it got to be that point where I looked around, and I mean, he was stoned out of his gourd. He couldn't hardly walk, and he was a very quiet person, and the band had sat down. They had a break, and I look out there, and there's Tommy dancing, singing just as loud as he could. I'm not a dancer. I'm a lover. By this time, we had six children we had had. And he says, I'm not a dancer, I'm a lover, and I got six to prove it. And I thought, oh, God, I wanted to come under the table. I mean, he was so embarrassing. And he got to the point where I was driving, and his drinking was different, and I could not understand that. And my mother even told me, my mother and I never did really have a good relationship, but, you know, it hurts when your mother says, well, do you think that he drinks because of you? I mean, come on, Mom, you know. This really hurt me. Well, as the time passed, he drank more and more, and we became more and more isolated. We didn't go around our family much, my family much. I was ready to solve everybody in the neighborhood's problem. I used to say I had the saltiest shoulder on Sullivan Drive because, you see, everybody else's life was interesting because I had none. I would sit and watch soap operas, folding diapers. You know, diapers was a never-ending thing with me. And I'd watch these soap operas, and because I had no life. Somebody else's life had to be more interesting. Well, as time passed, things got worse and worse and worse. There were a lot of things that happened that took me some time in this program to forgive. We cannot, at least I can only speak for me. I do not speak for Al-Anon, I only speak for me. I have to forgive, but that doesn't mean I have to forget. But my attitude about it can be so much changed. I can laugh about things that were at the time were just absolutely horrendous to me. I had no sense of humor. Everything was a disaster. I lived from one crisis to another. Well, I looked around, and he had left. He worked for Light, Gas, and Water. He had left the company and did not get a leave of absence. They said he wasn't eligible. We found out later he was. And so he takes all of his retirement money, and he goes to work for this other guy who I know today is an alcoholic. And they didn't do any business. They just sat around and drank beer all day, you know, and talked about how they were going to buy all of this equipment and they're going to have this kind of company. And so the company naturally was losing money, so Tommy comes in. He didn't say a word to me. He drew everything we had out of the bank and gave it to this man to keep the business floating. Well, he went down with the business, and we went down. And at that particular time, I was having my sixth child. And I go to the hospital. Now, my faith in God, you know, had always varied. When I came into this program, I knew a lot about God because I'd been to all of these churches, I had studied these denominations, I had studied the Bible, and I knew a lot about God, but I did not know God. And so this program was a turning point for me in that. Well, I was not so cool and kosher myself, I'll tell you. I had so much anger in myself. At one time, I was working three jobs, and I had to look at that and say, who's sick here? You know, I was working one in the morning for a bedding company collection. I worked in the afternoon. I kept children after Montessori school, and at night I was the manager of a card shop. And you have to stop and think. I thought everything depended on me. I really felt the weight of the world, and if I didn't do it, it wouldn't get done. Now, I don't know how many of you gals and guys have ever felt that way that have lived with alcoholism. That's exactly what was going on. There's an introduction in this little, my pamphlet is falling apart, called Alcoholism, a Family Disease. And then at the very front, Bill Wilson, co-founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, says, any family, wife, or children who have had to live with an alcoholic any number of years are bound to become erratic, neurotic, and distorted. They cannot help it. And that's exactly the way I came. My anger was such, it was terrible. I had it bad when I was a child. I can remember my brother telling me, yak, yak, calling me 4 hours. I said, you say that again to me, and I'm going to throw this can opener, the old can that had a point, and you hit it, and You give it like that. You call me 4 hours one more time, I'm going to throw this at you. And he, 4 hours, and thunk. I threw it, and it stood in his arm and just shaved. So you see, I had all these character defects before I ever met an alcoholic. But alcoholism is that fertilizer that brought it out. And you know what fertilizer is, so that's what it did for me. One time when I was working, I had given up the three jobs, and I had the opportunity to have a real good job in a major grocery chain in Memphis, and I worked in the office. And by being the low man on the totem pole, I had worked the night shift, night deal. So I got off about 2:30 in the morning. This was in a winter time. And I had on a big, heavy corduroy coat, and I had a handbag that looked like a suitcase almost. It just always, you know, I always said, if I ever got hit by a car, I'd have everything I need in my purse, you know, to survive. So I went out. At this particular time, they were building a mall next door, and they had a 6-foot cyclone fence up, because they had all that area off. And there were no lights on the lot where I worked. And I got off at 2:30 in the morning, and I got my key, and I stuck it in the car, in the keyhole. And this guy grabbed me by the arm. And when he grabbed me, I guarantee you, every morsel of anger that was ever inside of me from my toes came up. And when he grabbed this arm, I took that handbag and I whacked him right across, knocked him off balance, pushed him down to it was a parking lot, straddled this man, and beat the living stuffings out of him. He started crawling under the car, and I reached up and grabbed his leg and said, come back here, you... And I got him. He was screaming and hollering, and I guarantee you, I had blood. I didn't have any skin on my knuckles. I went absolutely crazy. That man was screaming, lady, let me go, let me go, let me go. And he finally got away, and I think I just got tired, I don't know. And he jumped that 6-foot fence and went down Highway 51. The reason I tell you this is anger, anger. So, you know, I firmly believe, I don't know about you, but I know about me, I have that capability, and it scares me to death. It scares me to death. I became really smart, see? He was the drinker. He was the sick one. I was okay because I wasn't drunk all the time. So I thought, well, I noticed he was losing time. He couldn't remember what was going on, when. And so I thought, well, how sick I was. If I could drive him crazy, I could get his insurance money. So who's crazy here? Well, so I started moving the furniture. I turned off all the lights when he'd come in at night. I started moving the furniture, and I moved the bed on the opposite side of the wall. And he comes in one night, and it was pitch black dark in there. We lived out in the county, and there was no street lights. And he comes in, and he said, honey, here's your sweetheart. I'm home, darling. And he comes running in the bedroom and jumps and whoo! On the floor he went, and he hit his head on the side of the nightstand, and he bled. And I turned on the light, and I said, oh, good night. I turned off the light and went to bed. I did all sorts of things to drive him crazy. Some of you may remember Jack Parr. He was the granddaddy of the night show, you know. Well, he had this doctor whom I met later. He was a dentist from Georgia, and he was talking about alcoholism. Well, I knew Tommy drank so much, but I didn't know about alcoholism. So I had been reading, you know, Ladies' Home Journal and all these good magazines to tell me all about, you know, drinking and alcoholism. And so he was on there that night, and he said, he's talking about the progression of this disease. And he said, you know, in the early stages, an alcoholic can drink and drink and drink, get up early the next morning, go to his golfing buddy's house, you know, and time to go play golf, and he's off and running, you know. Then it gets to the point where he's a little late for the golf game and all. And then it gets to the point where I call them weak-bladdered willies. And he says, you know, they wake up, you wake up in the middle of the night, and they're in the puddle. And I thought, that was going to speed this up, this awareness up a little bit. So I got a little plastic bucket-like and a sponge and lukewarm water. Didn't want it too cold and didn't want it too hot. I wanted it just right. So I put the sponge in there in the water and I pushed it under the bed. So when he came in, I laid there like, sound asleep. And when I thought he was really, I didn't know whether he was asleep or passed out. And I took that sponge, and it's amazing how much noise squeezing water out of a sponge makes in a quiet room. I was scared he was going to wake up. So I squeezed the sponge out, but just left enough in it, and I'd reach over, and just at the strategic spot, I'd squeeze that sponge, and then I'd lay there real quick, put it underneath it. He got up four times that night. Now, he didn't sleep in pajamas. He slept in what he calls skivvies, shorts. And I woke up the next morning in the bathroom all across the shower wide was four pair of shorts. He never mentioned a word, never said a word. And, it didn't work. It didn't work because he just kept drinking the way he did. Well, it got to the point where my children were really neglected. My kids would come up and they'd want me to help them with homework and stuff. And I'd say, honey, I got to worry about your daddy. I can't help you. Go get so-and-so. Go across the street and get Ms. What's-her-name. I really relinquished every kind of love and attention to my kids. I'm not proud of this. But this is what this disease of alcoholism does to a family. Well, I had been thinking very seriously about leaving. And today I didn't have to plan a suicide or a homicide because I had considered very seriously killing Tommy some way. But by being a police officer's daughter, I was afraid there'd be one juror that would, wouldn't believe my story. I had even bought a burying suit for him, and I wouldn't let him wear it. I bought me a black outfit, and I had the little net hat thing that would come across here. Because I wanted to have enough room so somebody kissed me on the cheek and say, you're so sorry. And I was going to be singing inside, I'm glad you're gone, you devil, you rascal, you. But, my mind got just as squirrely as could be. Well, I had decided I didn't want a divorce, but I wanted to separate. I didn't really know what I wanted, to tell you the truth, but I knew I could not live like this any longer. And so I took a 40-day leave of absence, and I'd made a retreat. I didn't tell you, I did a lot of things about leaving six children with an active drunk. But the strange thing about it, I took a trip to Europe one time. Now, this is crazy. My aunt left me some money and another friend who's, they're in the program. My husband 12-stepped him and I 12-stepped her. We had all we could take and she borrowed money from her mother and we went to Europe for 29 days. Left six kids with a drunk. So you see, my perspective was always off. But you know what? I can look back now and say, it was the best thing I ever did for me. Because when I came back, my head was a little bit more clearer. And when I took this 40-day leave of absence, I came in, and Tommy said, guess what I did for you today? Well, at that time, I didn't care what he did one way or another. But see, I wasn't even honest with myself. I loved him, but I tried to tell myself I couldn't love him. And when they told me later on it was okay to love an alcoholic, I thought, because I thought there was something wrong with me, because I love this man. And I'd say I didn't care whether he got drunk or whether he got sober, and I had lied to me so long. Well, he said, guess what I did for you today? And I said, I don't know. He said, I called Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, I'm not the drunk. I don't need Alcoholics Anonymous. He says, I called him, and this guy I used to play baseball with came over, and we talked all afternoon. And he said, I promised him that we would be at this meeting tonight. I said, we? And he said, yeah. I said, you got a mouse in your pocket or something? Because you ain't talking for me. And he said, no. He said, now, I've told him, he says, he's a real nice guy, and I told him that I was sure that you'd be interested, and you'd go, well, resentment, up like that. So I went into the bathroom and I got cleaned up, and the first thought was it came to me, what would people think if I didn't go and support him? A, I didn't know anybody about there. I didn't know anything about AA. Who were these people that I were going to try to impress? So I said, well, okay. And we went to Neely Road Group when it was on Neely Road, and this was in 1974. And this was my first Al-Anon meeting. In his first AA meeting, but I did everything I could not to get to that Al-Anon meeting. We walked in, and he's dead now, so I can use his name. Jack Houston was there, and he came in, and he stuck his hand out to me. I'm so glad you came, and I thought, you don't know him, And he shook his hand. We're so glad you came. And he said, we'll have an AA meeting in here. And Tommy introduced me. He says, this is my wife, Joan. He says, well, Joan, honey, we've got a room over here for you. It's a group of Al-Anons, families and friends of alcoholics. And I said, no, sir, I'm not going in there. And he said, well, this is a closed AA meeting. I said, I don't care whether it's closed or not. I'm not going in there. I'm going with him. He says, well, you can't go in there. I said, look, mister, and I called him mister. I said, mister, you don't understand. He has a great tendency to lie. If you want to know what he's doing, you ask me. And that's the way it went. Well, he stood there, and you'd have to know Jack Houston. He says, you can't go in there. You can't go in there. So I, you know, stuck my head down and I wiggled in there. And I saw these, you know, now steps and traditions on the wall, and those, you know, live and let live and think and let go and let God. And I looked around, I thought, oh, I'm in here with the psalm singing skinny old maids. I ain't gonna like this, not one bit. Well, they started sharing a little bit, and, you know, I wanted to know all about them. And they shared a little bit about what was going on in their house, and I thought I was the only one that lived like that. And I turned around and I thought, well, they asked me if I had any questions. Well, knowing me, I was full of them. I want to know all about you, but I didn't want you to know anything about me. I mean, it was inside and it was going to stay there. But you know, at that first night, one woman said something about, your husband may not drink and he may continue to drink, but this program is for you, that you can survive, that this is for the families and friends. And this came out in a pamphlet later, and it was what stuck with me. Your serenity does not depend on his sobriety. And I thought, man, that's almost like Greek, you know? And I learned all of these little different things, but that woman gave me hope that night, and I had decided if my husband decided to go down the tube of alcoholism, I didn't have to go with him. I didn't really have to do that. And so we were going, came home, and this meeting was four blocks from our house. It could have been walking distance. And I said, what did you think about it? He said, oh, it's great. Oh, so those people, it really has helped them. And he says, but you know, I hadn't had those things happen to me. I've never been in jail. I've never been in the back of a squad car. I've never lost a job. I still have that wife and six kids. And I said, but maybe not for long. And I meant it. I meant it. And I think for the first time he heard that. But he went on out and had nine more months of experience, and he called it underground. I went to Al-Anon underground. I never told him I was going. I don't really know why. I don't know whether I was afraid that he would scream and holler or nag me. I don't know, but I never told him. Then he came in one night, and I'm not going to tell his story, but I had finally gotten a sponsor. And sponsorship is very important to me, particularly in this program. And my first sponsor was Baptist, had no children. I was Catholic and had six. But that didn't enter into anything about this program. She helped me with those first three steps. And the first thing I had to learn was to surrender. Surrender. And she said, you're going to have to change a lot. And I said, what? What am I going to have to change? She says, everything. And so it was true. I had to unlearn more when I first started this program than I did learn. Because, you see, I had been told as a child, if you can't control a situation, you're not worth your salt. My dad used to, and I loved my dad. But society and my family had given me a lot of misinformation. I thought what was taking care of self was selfish. I was always told, you know, you're the last one in the line. I can remember calling my sponsor one time later, and I said, my children don't show me the respect I think I'm due. I'm working, and I'm trying to take care of them, and I'm trying to make ground beef out of my tongue with their daddy. And I'm not talking back, but they're not showing me respect. And she said, well, how are you treating them? I said, well, I do good. I fix their dinner, and I put it on the plate. And I said, oh, but cut their meat. And she says, and when do you eat? And I said, after everybody gets what they want. She says, don't you know you're treating your children that you're last and you don't count? She says, be good to yourself. Work with your children. You're not the slave. The day of human sacrifice is over, Joan. And I thought, gee, this woman is wise. You know, she was really smart. Well, this sponsor helped me with a lot of those things. Came to believe. We used to hear it a lot. We came to believe. And you know, for me, today, even today, I can believe something, and 2 days later, I don't believe it. I will know something. And so I think that second step is in the right place for me, because I came to believe. I knew about God, as I had told you, but I didn't have this relationship with God. But then I began to really believe and to know that God does care for me. First of all, I had to remember I wasn't God. Because, you see, I had that attitude that because he was drinking and I wasn't, that I was smarter than him, that I knew better than he did. Well, so I had to say that I wasn't God. And then I had to really realize that God is in my life. I can look back like that clock that was broken twice a day. God is the one that put those signs for me. And so if he loves me, then I know today whatever happens is going to be that God is going to love me through anything that's difficulty, and he's going to love me and smile when things are great. Now, when I came into this program and we were talking about these steps, when they talk about a good day is if I had my way. You know, if everything went my way. So then she taught me resentment was because I didn't get my way in the past. And when you're angry, you're not getting your way today. And when you're fearful, you're afraid you're not going to get your way tomorrow. And so she says, you got to trust God. You got to clean the house. And so we got into this program. When we did the third step, we knelt down and we said the prayer. And then I came to her and I said, I want to do the fourth step. And I got the shock of my life. She said, I can't help you there. And I said, why not? And she said, well, you know what, I've lost my watch. Somebody's going to have to tell me what time it is. Oh, I've got it on me. I'm not crazy. I took it off. See, I am recovering. Oh, but she says, I can't help you. And I said, why not? She says, I haven't made a fourth step. I was like this. And she says, my sponsor's getting ready to fire me because I hadn't made a fourth step. And I said, who's your sponsor? Do you mind telling me? And she said, Eloise. I said, Eloise, I've heard that name. And she said, do you think she'd take me on? She says, I think about this and pray about it. And I said, well, why? She says, she's tough. And I said, well, she could take me through my fourth step, couldn't she? She said, yeah. So I said, well, give me her number. I called her. I thought, oh, when she answered that phone, I may have made a mistake. And really, I don't mean anything against the women's armed forces. I have a daughter in there. But when she answered that phone, she said, hello. And I said, Eloise, this is Joan. Yeah, what do you want? I said, I told her the name of my sponsor. So she says she's not, you're getting ready to fire her because she hadn't made a fourth step and I need to start a fourth step. Yeah, that's right, getting ready to fire her. So she ain't doing that. She says, we don't do that Al-Anon dance, you know, just 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. And I said, well, would you be my sponsor? And she said, yeah, but she says, there's something I want you to know. And I said, yes, ma'am. She said, I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, been from 25 years, and I'm a member of Al-Anon for 12 years. And she said, I just want you to know that I don't sponsor anybody that doesn't read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous or the AA 12 and 12. I said, I can read. She says, I don't mean just read it. She says, the first time you read it, you'll see him. Second time, you'll see your isms. That's what you're suffering from is the isms. And so Eloise took me through that fourth step, but she went back to step one first. And we worked up to the fourth step and then into the other steps. And then she reminded me on the fifth step that when it says to God, to another human being, to myself, God, and another human being, she says, you got to remember, God is present when we do this. There's going to be no hedging. There's not going to be any embellishing. And it's not going to be anything but the truth as you know it. And she says, this won't be the first time that you'll do this. She says, I don't believe that you do these steps one time and you're over the hill. Well, I got into this program working with Eloise. And she had the audacity to die. And I missed her terribly. Some of you may know her. I dearly loved her husband, too, is Franklin Williams. He lived in Mississippi. And Franklin was a big help to me, too. He was a wonderful, wonderful man. When Eloise died, I called one of the sweetest, dearest people I know, and she'd been in Al-Anon before Al-Anon had a name, and that was Hazel D. Hazel, she's still alive, and her husband is the one that started the Harbor House in Memphis. One thing that I like to talk about, too, is the Al-Ateen program. We had six children, and unfortunately, the first four did not have the opportunity to go to Al-Ateen. The last two were girls, and I told them one night, I said, you know, when I came to Al-Anon, I didn't want to go to Al-Anon. I wanted my life to be completely different, and circumstances forced me into this program, and God was good enough to show me and lead me to this program. And I said, you're teenagers now, and there is a program for you. It's called Al-Ateen.
Well, we don't need that stuff, you know.
And I said, well, I'm going to tell you something. They told me when I first came to make at least six meetings before I make up my mind whether Al-Anon is for me. And you are going to six meetings whether you like it or not. And then at the end of six meetings, if you don't like it, I'll never mention it again. Well, these girls, the first night they got in the car, and they were swelled up like poison pups, you know. They didn't want to go. Second night, they were, you know, we're going to go, you know, wish you were. After that, they went to Al-Ateen until they graduated from high school. And they maintained relationships, friendships, while many of their friends went to different colleges. And it's just the greatest thing in the world. And I'll tell you, these programs of AA, Al-Anon, and Al-Ateen will turn any house back into a home. It is the foundation. As I said, I knew a lot about my higher power, but I did not know God. My husband died May the 22nd in 2002. We were married 50 years and 5 days. Thank you. Thank you. And this man that I had grown to hate, I grew to love and absolutely adore. To me, he was Mr. AA. Of course, I know he wasn't. There is no Mr. AA. Although I tell Ralph he borderlines, you know. We would get the books out. I'd get the Al-Anon books. And early on, they didn't have that many Al-Anon books, but we'd get the AA book and the 12 and 12, and then the Al-Anon 12 and 12 came out. Dilemma of an Alcoholic Marriage. And a lot of times after a meeting, we'd get the books out and put it on the bed, and we'd talk about a step. And I didn't pry about, you know, anything that he had done in his past life, but I'd say, you know, I was interested. How do you see this step? How do you see this step? And so the big book has been very meaningful to me. I really could not. I can't say today, and I meant to say this to start, you alcoholics, I don't understand you guys. Don't understand you at all. And you don't understand me. Because, see, it's not been my experience to be an alcoholic. I could never say, I know just how you feel. Because I haven't felt that. Now, I have felt the isms from the disease. My husband could never understand how I could take a drink and walk off and leave it. Or I could have part of a drink and the ice melt. I can remember him saying in the days when he was drinking, drink that damn thing. You know, don't let the ice melt, you know. And I couldn't understand that. The first time I heard in a meeting that the alcoholic suffered, oh God, I cringed because, see, I had a flashback of when he had his first back operations, which he later had six back operations, two of them fusions, three open heart surgeries. He had many, many different surgeries, knee surgery, and that man never complained, never. But with his first back operation, I was at work and they called me and they had him at the emergency room. He was so drunk, it was unreal. And I went into that emergency room, and he was babbling and hollering and carrying on, making the biggest scene. And this doctor came up and said, Miss Hassler, I'm sorry, your husband is so drunk, he's got so much alcohol in his body, I can't give him anything for pain. And you know what I said? good. Good. I mean, revenge was mine. So you see, these things come back to really haunt us. Before I retired, one of the greatest pleasures that God ever gave me is that I studied and I became, you're going to love this, a probation officer. Now, in the drinking days, I would have given a kingdom to be that, you know, when they had the drunks in there. But today, I just retired really 2 years ago, and every now and then he calls me. But today, I can look at these people who have problems with alcohol and drugs, and I really tell them, you're not a bad person who needs to get good. You're a sick person who needs to get well. And it's only through the grace of God which side of this desk I am on. And I truly mean that. Because, you see, I could never pay back to this program what it's given me. And one of the things that I'd like to emphasize more than anything is that there are three legacies to this program. It's not just the steps. It's not just the steps in the traditions. It's not just the steps in the traditions. And then you've got to have service. Because, you know, it says over and over, you can't keep it unless you give it away. And I love the new little booklet out by Al-Anon. It says, when I got busy, I got better. And the first time I got into service, big mouth, questions, you know, our GR was moving to Jackson, Mississippi. And at that time, I belonged to Graceland Group. And I didn't even tell you, I belonged to Singleness of Purpose. We meet Friday night at Highland Street Church of Christ, and we'd love to have you at 6 o'clock. But at any rate, our GR was moving to Mississippi, and I said, what's a GR? Zoomp, they pull off and said, you'll learn. So if you're new, you listen, and then you ask. But service work has been a real important part of my program. I truly love the alcoholic. And Al-Anons are, they're the most wonderful people in the world. I have a badge I wish I could have worn. It says, Al-Anons are beautiful. And to me, they are. And on the other one, it says, trust God, clean house, and help others. And I thank y'all this morning for your attention. And if nobody's told you today that they loved you, let me tell you. I'd like to be the first, second, third, or whatever. I love you today. Thank you.